Going North, Transportation and Tourism in the White Mountains by Guy Gosselin. So far as travel into the White Mountains is concerned, the entire period prior to the mid-1820s has sometimes been popularly characterized as having been limited to the visits of a few scientists and adventurers whose purpose was to explore Mount Washington and its surroundings. It is true that early pleasure travel was infrequent. Nonetheless, there was significant local impetus for improved routes and methods of transportation and for hostelries along the way. The 10th New Hampshire Turnpike through Crawford Notch, which was chartered in 1803, was a crude thoroughfare used by the farmers, tradesmen, and drovers of the northern Connecticut Valley area on their way to markets south of the Notch. In his 1916 study of the White Mountains, Frederick Kilbourn referred to long lines of wagons loaded down with merchandise of various descriptions passing through the gateway both summer and winter, and noted the existence there of simple taverns as early as the last decade of the 18th century. References to commercial use of the turnpike through Crawford Notch, however, are rare in Lucy Crawford's 1846 account of the mountains, in spite of the fact that her husband, Ethan Allen Crawford, was very much involved in its maintenance. Still, the reader can get the idea that Ethan's considerable labor on the road was entirely for the benefit of the very few gentlemen and ladies who made use of his establishment. Zadok Long, who took a trip through Crawford Notch in 1832, provides a very different, almost roisterous picture of the Notch that helps dispel the impression of lonely isolation which prevails in some writings. According to him, the route was much used by Vermonters to reach the Portland, Maine market. And he quotes one of the Crawfords as saying that on one occasion prior to 1832, 87 spans of horses had been put up at Crawford's Inn in one night. It isn't clear how so many animals could have been put up other than by having them tethered to trees in the yard. If true, the human guests must have awakened to a fragrant and slippery morning. The tourists of the day, those people of wealth and leisure who visited the mountains out of curiosity, were few until as late as 1826. One account indicates that only 7 guests signed Ethan Crawford's register in 1819, hardly a source of great profit. But Ethan exerted great effort on behalf of those early tourists, and traffic grew steadily as satisfied visitors related their experiences to others. Such improvements as Crawford's carriage road to the base of Mount Washington and his path to the summit became subjects of animated conversation in the drawing rooms of Boston and Lowell. It was a disaster, however, that created the first marked increase in the rate of visitation. The famous tragedy involving the Willie family, in which a landslide wiped out all its members and 2 hired men in 1826 under unusual circumstances, created such a stir that, according to Peter Bulkley, hundreds of visitors flocked to the White Mountains in the fall of 1826 and thereafter to see the site of the strange disaster. Further evidence of how sensational or morbid events can stimulate tourism may also be recalled by the Cherry Mountain Slide of 1885, in which one person and several farm animals were killed and a farmstead was destroyed. The slide occurred near the tracks of the Whitefield and Jefferson Railroad, and within hours, excursions were being run from Boston to the site. Tents of enterprising salesmen quickly dotted the area, and it was possible for some time to view Farmer Stanley's one-horned cow, a celebrity because the other horn had fallen victim to the slide. Returning to Crawford Notch, however, the travelers of the early 19th century required as much in the way of stamina and patience as they did of time and money. The condition of the road through the Notch was extremely poor, one visitor likening his trip to traveling over a dry riverbed. Bulkley observed that the predominant means of transportation between 1820 and 1850 was the stagecoach. Over hill and down dale, the ride was jolting and quite uncomfortable, especially when squeezed between other passengers. He stated elsewhere that the trip from Boston to Crawford's Inn in 1823 consumed about 4 days. As late as 1850, one left Portland by stage at 7 in the morning and clattered 55 miles to Conway, New Hampshire, where it was then necessary to spend the night. The trip to Crawford Notch resumed the next morning at 6 a.m. Zadok Long, who came from Maine, was almost alone in proclaiming that the road through the Notch was good. Outside the craggy ramparts of the White Mountains, there were forces at work, however, that would eventually provide the means by which many more people would travel for pleasure, and that would at the same time foster the technological innovations to transport them with comparative ease. The relentless process of industrial revolution was expanding available wealth and was giving birth to a middle class of industrialists, bankers, professionals, and shopkeepers. Among the engineering marvels of the period was the steam locomotive, which emerged at first as a poor competitor to the horse in this country about 1837. But railroad technology improved rapidly, and a network of steel gradually radiated from the population centers of the Northeast toward the retreating wilderness and toward the White Mountains. By 1840, rails linked Boston and Portsmouth. 2 years later, trains were chuffing into Portland, Maine. The earliest White Mountain guidebooks called attention to the fact that the two trains arriving daily in Portland in 1846 left the traveler with a much more manageable journey by stagecoach to mountain destinations. It was in 1846 that construction commenced on the Atlantic and St. Lawrence Railroad from Portland to Island Pond, Vermont, where it eventually met its northern counterpart, the St. Lawrence and Atlantic Railroad from Montreal. The principal reason for the construction of this line was also commercial, namely to provide an ice-free port for the shipping of Canadian wheat and other goods. At first, there was some question about the most desirable route and whether Portland or Boston should be the southern terminus. From the point of view of the railroad, it made sense to augment the all-important freight business with a passenger component. It seems clear that the well-known potential for tourist traffic to the White Mountains influenced the decision to lay track through Gorham. This choice would profoundly and permanently change the character of tourism in the White Mountains. From 1851 on, a trade that had been measured in hundreds of people would now be measured in tens of thousands. The development of White Mountain tourism would have proceeded very differently had the original route proposed for the Atlantic and St. Lawrence Railroad through Dixville Notch been selected. Historians have long noted the connection between the coming of the railroad and the rise of the tourism industry in the White Mountains, but it was not until the significance of Ezra Beale's journal was discovered recently by Jane Radcliffe, formerly of the Maine State Museum, that it was possible to document the extent of that connection. Born in 1797, Ezra Beale was a native of Norway, Maine. Well-educated, he spent time as a respected schoolteacher before becoming a builder and contractor. An enthusiastic supporter of the early plans for the Atlantic and St. Lawrence Railroad, he invested in the enterprise and quickly was named one of only two directors on the United States side of the line. This association proved to be very fruitful for Beale, since he contracted extensively with the railroad and ended up building most of the stations on the southern portion of the line. His most famous structures, however, were probably the U.S. Hotel and the Falmouth House, both in Portland. In the White Mountain region, however, Beale's most significant edifice was undoubtedly the White Mountain Station House, built in Gorham in 1851, and better known later as the Alpine House. The word station in the building's earliest name is misleading to us today, since the structure was principally a hotel intended for the use of the railroad's passengers. The journal contains many details about the actual construction and describes the dedication on the 23rd of July. A train of six cars left Portland in the morning with 250 invited guests, who, with several more on the line, attended and dined. After a jolly time, a great number of fine speeches and toasts, the company left at 5 p.m. well satisfied. The Beale Journal contains some surprises. For example, the entry for July 8, 1851, the White Mountain Station House is not yet complete at this time, states, "We have eight men or more at work on the White Mountains, nearly at the top of Mount Washington, making a horse road." This horse road was not the carriage road, which was commenced in 1854, but the Glen House Bridle Path. The bridle path was hitherto thought to have been an 1853 improvement made by Colonel Joseph Thompson, who, it was further believed, took over the task from John Bellows, the original owner of what would later become the Glen House property. Not so. Beale's men, one of whom was Franklin Levitt, the Lancaster, New Hampshire mapmaker, were nearly finished with the job early in July of 1851. As for the sale of the Bellows property to Thompson, Beale, at that new center of North Country activity, the White Mountain Station House, relates on April 14, 1852, that "Mr. Thompson today is at the station house for the purpose of settling with Bellows for his hotel and premises." We have to wonder how much the railroad had to do with arranging this transaction on behalf of an experienced hotelier. Other significant entries in the Beale Journal have to do with the construction in 1850 of what is still known in Gorham as the Glen Road, a direct route from the White Mountain Station House to the Glen. Prior to that time, the route to Gorham from Pinkham Notch had been by way of Randolph and then eastward. Now, passengers on the Atlantic and St. Lawrence were able to alight from the train, board a stage, and be at the base of Mount Washington in an hour or so. Activity in and around Gorham in the early 1850s was extraordinary, and nowhere do we get a clearer indication of that than in Beale's journal. The road from Gorham to the future site of the Glen House was completed in the summer of 1850. In December of that same year, workmen framed the White Mountain Station House, a job that was mostly accomplished in the teeth of a northern New Hampshire winter. Guests were already staying at the station house a few weeks before the track was opened to Gorham on July 28, 1851. The Glen House bridle path was also built that summer. Later that year, Beale met with hotel entrepreneurs Horace Fabian and Colonel Gibbs of the Crawford House. Colonel Thompson bought out Bellows early in 1852 and set to work creating the Glen House. While Thompson was busy with the Glen House, Joseph Hall, who had earlier built the Crawford bridle path, was engaged in bringing materials up the Glen House bridle path with which to build the first summit house on Mount Washington. That summer also, S.B. Beckett, in the company of individuals familiar with the area, explored Pinkham Notch, looking for wonders to include in his guidebook of the Atlantic and St. Lawrence and St. Lawrence and Atlantic Railroads. The Tip Top House was built the following year, 1853, the same year that General David O. Maycomber and his group of investors obtained a charter for the construction of the carriage road. The pace is breathtaking. Gorham was booming as the northern gateway to the White Mountains, the only gateway directly served by a railroad. Two new first-class hotels were in operation, the summit of Mount Washington was being developed, tourists were pouring into the area, the Mount Washington carriage road was on the drawing board, and present everywhere was the hand of the Atlantic and St. Lawrence Railroad. An entrepreneurial fever was evident also, spreading rapidly through the North Country in anticipation of a coming economic bonanza. The link between the emergence of the railroad and the rise of tourism, duly noted before by historians, came to life in fascinating detail. Before long, competing railroads were approaching the western foothills of the mountains. In 1848, travelers from Concord, New Hampshire, could make it to Crawford Notch in a day by taking the Northern Railroad most of the way to Wells River, Vermont, and then by staging into the mountains. The Boston, Concord, and Montreal Railroad, which would later become the Boston and Maine, reached Littleton in 1853. Because it was a financially troubled line, however, it was slow in turning east toward the mountains, and consequently did not have the same early impact on area tourism as had the Atlantic and St. Lawrence. In assessing the importance of the western routes from 1861 to 1869, it must be remembered that to the extent that the summit of Mount Washington was the goal of tourists, it could most conveniently be reached from the east via the carriage road. The BC&M did, however, bring passengers to within easy stagecoach range of the scenic wonders and the hotels of the Franconia and Crawford Notches. Rails were also slow in reaching Conway, the Portland and Ogdensburg finally making it there in 1871. For those travelers who were more interested in the substance of the journey than the destination objective, it was possible to include steamer connections, principally on Lake Winnipesaukee, in their mix of conveyances. Eventually, the Western railroads achieved prominence as the tourist focus shifted somewhat from the east to the west, from the carriage road to the Cog Railway. The carriage road, which was completed in 1861, enjoyed a virtual monopoly in conveying passengers to the summit of Mount Washington until 1869, when the Cog Railway was completed. Thereafter, until the automobile came into widespread usage in the 1920s, the pattern of usage was reversed, with the cog being perceived as the most modern and efficient means of ascending the mountain. Just as the opening of the carriage road had led to a refurbishment of the summit buildings to accommodate larger crowds, the opening of the Cog Railway resulted in yet another surge of activity on the summit. A new summit house was built that was almost a grand hotel in its own right. The Signal Corps weather station was constructed, and the newspaper Among the Clouds was established with its own summit office and printing shop. Furthermore, tourist interest in the Cog Railway boosted the passenger business of the Western Railroads. The BC&M's Wing Road line was opened to Fabians in 1874, and 2 years later, passengers were able to disembark directly onto the small coaches of the Cog Railway and continue to the top of the mountain. The P&O inched its way through Crawford Notch in a feat of construction engineering that remains a marvel in the history of the White Mountains. As described by Kilbourne, These improvements in traveling convenience eliminated many miles of arduous travel by stagecoach and encouraged the construction of new hotels and the enlargement of existing facilities. The numerous tourist facilities in the White Mountains, especially the larger hotels, could not have existed without the railroads. As previously noted, many of those huge enterprises were served directly by railroads, or in some cases had actually been built by a railroad. The railroads supplied the guests, who were transported quickly and in comfort, and they also carried the tons of perishables, fodder, and hard goods that were required by the grand resorts. No one would have thought during the height of the railroad era that the railroads could be significantly improved upon for those services. Even when the automobile made its appearance just before the turn of the century, few people believed that it would ever pose a threat to the future of railroading. The Gorham Mountaineer commented that as late as 1911, the use of automobiles on what would before long become the auto road was by special arrangement only. The automobile, however, eventually did take away most of the railroad's passengers, as the truck took away most of its processed and perishable freight business. Americans fell in love with the instant mobility and independence afforded by the auto, an affair which would dictate the next stage in the evolution of the tourist industry. Filling stations, tea houses, cabin towns, and campgrounds became part of the landscape during the 20s and 30s, and the life of the country took on a roadside character. Everything the motorist needed or didn't need was quickly and conveniently located by the side of the road. Moreover, the country continued to generate wealth on a scale that, by the early 50s, enabled all but the poorest citizens to own cars and travel. Today, the Mount Washington Auto Road, so reluctant to accommodate the automobile in 1911, gleefully collects fares from 1,000 cars or more on peak days. The effect of the automobile on the character of tourism in the 20th century has been as great as the influence of the railroads during the latter part of the 19th century. The automobile freed its driver from having to adhere to train schedules and made it possible for one to go wherever there was a road. As the automobile became more reliable, the time required for a trip to the mountains was also reduced. People could breakfast in Boston, visit the summit of Mount Washington, and return home the same day. Such day trippers now merited special consideration for a portion of the advertising dollars spent promoting tourism in the White Mountains. Unfortunately for the grand hotels, the speed, casual convenience, independence, and widespread affordability of the automobile did not fit the lifestyle for which the grand hotels had originally been designed. For many, the elegance and leisurely grace embodied in the grand hotels had become old-fashioned. While most motorists were still willing to get out of their cars to eat and sleep, many welcomed the ingenious ways by which those functions, as well as movie-going, banking, and even worship, could be performed from the driver's seat. Today, our marriage to the automobile seems secure. It is appropriate, therefore, to end with some of Plymouth State College historian William Taylor's observations on the impact of the automobile, not just on tourism, but on our culture. In his published writings, Taylor pointed out that where the fixed rights of way and terminals of the railroads promoted centralization, the automobile, and the road system constructed to accommodate it, contributed to the dispersal of our population. For the same reason, the once clear visual boundary that existed between the city and the countryside has become less and less distant. More important, perhaps, when we consider the future, is this assertion. The motor vehicle revolution has caused the demise of most public transportation within the state. Twice during the 1970s, we felt the effects of a fuel shortage on the economy. Since then, gasoline has been relatively plentiful, and we are content these days to ignore the possible future consequence of our near-total dependence on the personal vehicle. Tourism, travel to pleasant surroundings for the purpose of recreation, is irrevocably linked to transportation. Tourism in the future will be shaped by available transportation options, perhaps in ways that we are unable yet to appreciate.
Guy Goslin is former director of the Mount Washington Observatory in North Conway, New Hampshire. Historical New Hampshire, the only statewide history journal, has been a regular publication of the New Hampshire Historical Society since 1944. The Grand Resort Hotels and Tourism in the White Mountains was produced by the New Hampshire Historical Society and served as the proceedings of a symposium held by the Mount Washington Observatory at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in June 1994. The audio version of the Grand Resort Hotels, narrated by John Walters, and produced by Jody Peterson at Cliff House Audio for the New Hampshire Historical Society. Music performed by Colin McCaffrey. The Grand Resort Hotels, made possible with generous support from the Robert and Dorothy Goldberg Charitable Foundation and from Carolyn and Bryant Tolles.